preparing or going over this talk, looking at my first two transparencies, I was actually struck by how unnecessary they are for Perimeter, or in some ways how prescient and ahead of its time this institute has been in, I think, recognizing the importance of quantum information in quantum gravity. But I'll go over it anyway, and you can feel good about yourselves. Why do we study quantum gravity? Well, the story of physics is a story of unification, of explaining more and more things from fewer assumptions and fewer ingredients. And the remaining major challenge that we've been faced with for some time is to bring together quantum mechanics and gravitation. We have quantum field theories for the other known forces, but we don't quite have gravity yet under the same roof. And there are many reasons beyond just wanting no contradictions and a single unified theory. There are actual questions we'd like to answer, like whether time is like, you know, conductivity or you know, other emergent phenomena. Is it something truly fundamental, or is it just some kind of approximate concept that emerges in certain regimes? What happens deep inside a black hole? What happens when you hit a singularity? What happened at the beginning of the universe? Was there a beginning? Why did it begin? Why did it begin the way it did? All these questions are questions that we can reasonably expect to be able to answer only if we have a fully unified theory where both quantum mechanics and gravity can be dealt with simultaneously. So again, the story of quantum information and quantum gravity is a, I think, very exciting one, and one that I think has really accelerated in the last few years. It's clear now that quantum information is at least an important part of the language in which we need to approach the unification of gravity and quantum mechanics. It seems particularly well attuned to the problems that make the conflicts sharp. And so those are the places where we expect to make progress. What I'll talk about today is really a tiny corner of that story. What we're realizing is that by thinking about challenges in quantum gravity in the language of quantum information and formulating conjectures that are really meant to be conjectures about quantum gravity, we end up discovering new things about non-gravitational physics, physics which we are supposed to have understood already. And indeed, those things are results which we could have proven, we could have formulated, and we are now able to prove entirely within quantum field theory. So this, to me, is a wonderful sort of preview of the unity of nature that we're seeking, after all, that really quantum field theory, our non-gravitational description of nature, already knows something about quantum gravity, or else these properties would be very hard to understand from any natural perspective. Now, all of the developments that have taught us to take quantum information seriously, by the way, should we lower these lights a little bit, or can you see okay? Can you see Schwarzschild okay? All right. So all of those developments really started with the study of black holes, and of course, Karl Schwarzschild here is the first person to formulate, I mean, to write down a solution of Einstein's equations that describes a black hole. I don't think he understood as deeply as people did later how such an object would form and what that would look like. I think the first person there was to really describe that clearly was Oppenheimer, who I have to definitely show since he was at Berkeley. Here he's talking to one of our many excellent graduate students. And oh no, I shouldn't have said that. It doesn't matter. While we fix this problem, the information content of this slide was not actually as high as you might think. So I can just keep going, and you guys can take your time. My computer's still up, so good. What Oppenheimer realized is that when a black hole forms, there are really two very different stories that you can tell about that process. One is, you know, you see a star collapsing from far away, And the other story is from the point of view of somebody who's sitting on the surface of the star, or really a dust cloud, which is what Oppenheimer really described with Snyder. Those are two very different seeming stories. In the case where you're very far away, what you see is the cloud is collapsing, and then as its size nears the size of the event horizon of a black hole with that mass, it seems to just become frozen in that state, and it goes dark very, very quickly. And then later on, you can probe this. It's like a thing that you can probe. It has a certain size. If you lower your probes too deeply in, then you can't get them back out. But near the horizon, things behave as if the object has a sort of great gravitational acceleration. And later, we realize it also has a temperature. So those are the stories that you would tell if you're a faraway observer. But Oppenheimer also understood that if you sit on the surface of the star or the dust cloud as it collapses, then there is nothing special when you cross the event horizon. You just go in with the dust. There's no sign there, no dramatic events, or at least according to general relativity, there isn't. And so let's see if this comes back up. Okay, let's not experiment with the lights any further. Let me. Good, there we are. Oh, there we were. All right, I think we're back on. And so, again, probably most people in this room are very familiar with the notion of an event horizon. The event horizon is the sphere, in the simplest case, or in general, some sort of topological sphere, the surface that you better not cross if you want to get back out to distant regions. For a Schwarzschild black hole, its radius is proportional to the mass. And I'll now review a few of the key developments of the early study of quantum properties of black holes. Actually, I'll start with what seems like a purely classical property. You can ask what happens when two black holes merge. Right. Now, they have a certain amount of mass. Each of the black holes has a mass. But when they merge, the mass is, some of the mass is going to get radiated away. So it's definitely not going to be true that the total mass of the final black hole will be equal to the total mass of the initial black holes. But it turns out that there is some quantity which is monotonic, which is the horizon area. So if you take the event horizon of the first black hole and the second black hole and you add those areas together, the area of the final black hole that they form after they've merged has to be bigger than that or equal. And in fact, this was proven by Hawking in 1971. The way that it was sold at the time was actually as a way of limiting the amount of radiation that can come out, the amount of energy that can be emitted in gravitational waves. And it was, of course, recently confirmed by the actual merger of black holes that we've seen in LIGO. But back then, the numerical techniques were not very well developed, and it was an interesting bound that you could have on how much energy could actually be emitted in such a process. So this can be proven, but like all good theorems, there are assumptions. So first of all, we're using Einstein's equations, assuming general relativity, of course. But more specifically, what Hawking had to assume is that the energy density of matter is not negative. And let me be a little more specific. Of course, in special and general relativity, you don't just have the energy density. You have a tensor called the stress energy tensor. And you would contract that with some time-like unit vector twice to get what that observer would perceive as the energy density. Here we're doing something slightly different. We're taking that stress tensor, and we're contracting it twice with the same null vector, some vector that points along the direction of some light ray. And so that gives us a number. That number is, roughly speaking, the energy density as seen by that light ray, as seen by somebody moving at the speed of light. And what Hawking had to assume is that that is always non-negative. That's a relatively weak assumption that you can make. And it's certainly true for you and me and everything in this room. We have positive energy density as seen by both time-like and light-like observers. And it's clear you need some assumption like that, because if you could throw negative mass into a black hole, you could clearly make it smaller. So it's not surprising that something like that is indeed needed. But it was a very nice and elegant theorem. And it's part one of my story. Part two is a different question. So Hawking asked what happens to the area of black holes that merge. Bekenstein asked a different question. He asked what happens to the second law of thermodynamics in the presence of black holes. It was an odd question to ask. So if I have a ball of radiation or a box with some hot gas inside, and I throw it into a big black hole, most normal people would just say, well, now your entropy is inside the black hole. What do you want to know about that? It's not very interesting. If you want, jump after it, and there it'll be. But Bekenstein knew general relativity well enough to know that even if you jump after it, if you've waited long enough, you won't be able to see that box anymore. And it bothered him that that meant that you couldn't verify that the second law was still operating. To him, it mattered that, you know, the laws of physics didn't just refer to some object that wasn't reachable anymore somewhere deep inside a black hole, but it should mean something that you can check in an experiment that the entropy has not decreased. And that turned out to be the right way of thinking about the problem. That's not obvious. It bothered him, and so to fix that problem, he decided that black holes themselves must have entropy. It was similar to, you know, the problem of decreasing the entropy when you put a hot teacup in the fridge. Then you think about it for a moment, you realize the fridge heats the room. Aha, there's some other place where you're going to find entropy being produced and more than making up for that loss. So here, Bekenstein proposed that black holes themselves have an entropy. And of course, it was a very dramatic proposal because it was implicitly a statement about the number of quantum states of a black hole. So it was really a quantum gravity statement. His guess, inspired by the area theorem, was that the entropy of a black hole was just proportional to the area because there aren't that many things that don't decrease, and Hawking had just proven that the area is one of them. And then there were some natural units you could use, the Planck length squared, GH bar, so this involves both Newton's constant and Planck's constants. You can see it's quantum gravity. He didn't know about the one quarter. That was only fixed by Hawking's calculation later on. So the idea then is that you really have to, as usual, account for all of the contributions to the entropy. You can't leave some out and expect to find the second law satisfied. Bekenstein called this the generalized entropy. You take all of the ordinary entropy of all the stuff outside the black holes, and you add to that the area of all the black hole event horizons, if there's more than one black hole, otherwise just whatever one black hole has. And it's only that sum that satisfies a second law, which he called the generalized second law of thermodynamics. And here we see the first sign of this beautiful combination of the notion of geometry or gravity and quantum information. That's really the theme of this talk, and that has become so enriched in recent decades. You can literally add them together. So Bekenstein's idea then was that if I dump some entropy into a black hole, the black hole will hopefully grow by enough in area to make up for that lost matter entropy, and so the generalized entropy will not have decreased. Okay, so this was, of course, just a conjecture. And remarkably, it took almost 40 years for that conjecture to be proven, even in a limited setting of a semi-classical limit where you do an expansion in GH bar. And this is a beautiful proof due to Aaron Wall. It's remarkable how long this took. And oh yeah, I want to stress that everywhere where I talk about the entropy of ordinary matter, what I mean by that is something that's fairly sharply defined, namely the von Neumann entropy of the state of the quantum fields restricted to the exterior of the horizon. So you have some general state for the global state, which could be mixed or pure. You trace out the inside of the black hole, you get a density operator for the outside, you compute trace rho log rho. The other thing that I want to stress is that this sum is actually a little bit better defined than each of the terms separately. They both are cutoff dependent, but the sum is not. So that's that's the two stories that I wanted to tell, and now they come together in this very nice way where I should stress that Hawking actually at first thought that Bekenstein's idea was wrong. Why was Bekenstein's idea wrong that black holes have entropy? It's because if they have entropy, and they certainly have energy, then they have to have a temperature. And if they have to have a temperature, then black holes would have to radiate. And it was well known that black holes don't emit anything, so that was a stupid idea. Then, of course, Hawking sat down and did a completely different calculation of quantum fields on a black hole background, a very detailed, elaborate calculation in which he found that, indeed, what you have far from a black hole is thermal radiation at just the temperature demanded by the first law of thermodynamics, assuming Bekenstein's conjecture was right. And in fact, his calculation was so powerful that it fixed the order one prefactor. Now we know the entropy of a black hole is a quarter of the area in Planck unit. Now, that was a beautiful story, but I think what was even more beautiful about it is that Bekenstein had already solved a problem that he didn't even know about. The problem being that Hawking's area theorem is now evidently not actually true in nature. Right? If a black hole can evaporate, then as it emits radiation, its mass decreases, energy has to be conserved, so the area gets smaller. How is this possible? Well, the area theorem did assume the null energy condition, that energy density of matter is positive as seen by light. But it turns out that in quantum field theory, that's just not necessarily the case. Examples are Casimir energy. You can write down a lot of different states of like the standard model in which you have negative energy density in some region of space. It's just not always true. And one special and very important example where the energy density is locally negative is in the vicinity of the horizon of a black hole. And that's how black holes evade the area theorem when they evaporate. And so here's the remarkable thing. Bekenstein was trying to fix up the second law of thermodynamics by adding a, in some sense, gigantic correction to it. The area of black holes contributes to the entropy. But he had already fixed up Hawking's area theorem as well by adding a quantum correction to it. You can just as well consider the generalized second law to be, well, a fix-up of the ordinary second law, as you can consider it to be a quantum area theorem. It's just that's not how it was discovered. But it turns out that when those black holes emit radiation, the entropy of the radiation more than makes up for the lost area as the black hole shrinks. And so it could have been discovered. The generalized second law could have been discovered by first worrying about quantum corrections to the area theorem, say, when black holes evaporate. And then it's actually a small correction in general. And it's really, you know, the fact that neither law survives on its own. You need to combine geometry and information to have a law that is valid in the presence of black holes and quantum mechanics. That's sort of important about this. And the reason that I'm telling you all of that is, first of all, I needed to introduce this notion of generalized entropy anyway, but it's also because I wanted to give you a kind of blueprint or a model for what's about to follow for the new research that I want to describe. And the model is what you get by imagining a sort of revisionist history, an alternative history, in which the second law was actually discovered as a correction to the area theorem, as some quantum correction that fixes up the problem that the area by itself actually can sometimes decrease a little bit. And I want you to imagine something even more outlandish, namely that people didn't know about the second law of thermodynamics, but they were really good relativists and they understood how to compute entropy and so on. They just didn't know about the second law of thermodynamics. So Stephen could have discovered the second law of thermodynamics by the following argument. Okay, so he already had proven an area theorem. Then suppose he discovers Hawking radiation. Oh, the area actually doesn't always increase. It can decrease. Let me fix it up by adding a quantum correction. The exterior entropy has to be added to the area. It's the combined quantity that always increases. Now let me throw away, let me go back to this quantity, excuse me. Let me consider the case where there just isn't a black hole. Could happen, right? There's no black hole. Well, I've just made a conjecture that this combined quantity always increases. Well, then when there isn't a black hole, the entropy in the universe cannot decrease. It must always increase. And so he would have discovered the second law. Like all alternative facts, this one has a number of issues, and I don't want to go into them, but I wanted to convey the basic spirit, which is remarkable, I think. It's remarkable that you could have started with a classical gravity theorem. It's just classical general relativity. It inhabits an involved area. Realize that in certain situations where you include quantum effects perturbatively, the theorem is a little bit violated, but you have a way of adding a quantum correction to the statement so that it's, again, satisfied. So now you have a kind of semi-classical conjecture about quantum gravity that came from fixing up a GR theorem. Then you have some way of taking a limit where gravity becomes unimportant. You never would have thought it was even there. You have just a statement about quantum mechanics. And in this case, it wasn't new. It was old. The second law was already known. What I want to tell you about today is that we can actually do this starting with other GR theorems and discover something new about non-gravitational physics that, well, could have been known but wasn't. And in fact, it's far easier to discover it by this route than to prove it directly within quantum field theory, even though we can. And I'll describe how that works. So that's kind of what I'll describe in the rest of this talk. But that's the blueprint. That's what we want to do. And the fact that we can do it at all, I think, says something about how non-gravitational physics ultimately is already constrained by the fact that there must be a unified theory that includes both quantum field theory and gravity. So the theorem that I will start with, then make it a little bit quantum, then throw away the gravity part and get a new statement about quantum field theory, is called the focusing theorem in general relativity. It's actually much simpler than Hawking's area theorem. It takes much less time to prove it. Here are the ingredients. Okay. So first of all, it should have something to do with area, because we're ultimately going to just turn the crank and replace area by generalized entropy in the right places. Now, here I want you to think about a bunch of light rays, which, for example, are coming out of some surface, like you could imagine lining this wall with laser guns, and the laser guns all fire at some instant, and the light rays go across the room. And of course, in space-time, they're not just going across the room, they're also moving forward in time. And I'm going to be drawing light rays always going at 45 degrees to indicate that they're moving forward in time, but also across space. Okay. I'm going to show surfaces sometimes just by a dot. This could be a two-dimensional surface, such as an infinite wall or a sphere that divides space into two sides. Okay, this line here is all of space. This is really three-dimensional, right? And this is one side, and this is the other. And I can ask about something called the classical expansion. Okay, so ignore all these entropies for the time being. Let's just blow up a little piece of this surface here. Let's say it's a sphere, and I'm sending the light rays towards the inside of the sphere. So in space-time, there's a kind of cone that they're going to form. Locally, those light rays are moving together. If I look at one light ray, what are the neighboring light rays doing? They're moving towards that light ray. Right? That's something that I can capture mathematically by saying that the derivative of this area element here, this is some infinitesimal area element, along the light-like direction is negative. And really what you want to think about is the logarithmic derivative, because it's really the area loss per area that is a natural quantity to consider. So that's called the expansion. Okay? If the expansion is negative, that means that the light rays are locally contracting. If it's positive, that means the light rays are locally moving away from one another. That's really all there is, but that's an important quantity that we're going to have to think about. And the connection with area is there because what I'm really talking about is the the area element that's spanned by a bunch of neighboring light rays, is that element getting bigger or smaller? And that clearly depends both on the shape of the surface that I start the light rays out from, the direction that I send them to, and actually also on what space and time are doing, the curvature of space-time, while they're propagating. For example, if I send light rays to either side of certain spheres inside a black hole, nevertheless, they're both in both directions, they're contracting because all space is collapsing rapidly. Or near the Big Bang, if I look at big spheres, the light rays will be expanding towards the future, no matter which side I send them to. So in general, you don't know just from the shape of the surface what those light rays are going to do, but it's a classical geometric quantity you can always do. And the focusing theorem, it's really a dumbed-down version of the focusing theorem that we're starting from, is something that you can quickly derive from Einstein's equation. It's simply the statement that as you now follow the light rays and ask not what is happening to the area element, but already like one derivative further, what is happening to the expansion as I follow the light rays? What is its derivative? The statement is that that derivative is never positive. And the best way to think about that statement is as the sentence that gravity is attractive, or more precisely, that matter focuses light. Okay? Think about, for example, a bunch of light rays that are going parallel to one another. And let's say there's not a lot of matter around, there's not a lot of gravity happening, so they just keep on going parallel. They would have zero expansion to start with. Now we're asking about the change of the expansion that can happen. So initially it's not changing at all. Now suppose they encounter some matter. Think about bending of light by the sun or something like that, right? Which way are they going to get bent? They're not going to get bent like this by the sun. They get focused, not anti-focused, right? And so once they've passed the sun, they'll be moving towards each other. Now the expansion is negative. So we see that the derivative of the expansion is indeed negative in this example. And the statement is that this is always true. You can prove that this is always true in general relativity. But just like Hawking's area theorem, you need an assumption. And once again, the relevant assumption is this null energy condition, that the energy density of matter, this particular component of it, is not negative. And again, that makes sense. If I could replace the sun by an equal object of negative mass of the sun, then it's clear that you would get anti-focusing. So it has to do with the fact that the mass of ordinary objects is positive. We don't have objects that have, look like the sun but have negative mass, but we do know, as I've told you before, that this null energy condition is not, in fact, always satisfied. Quantum effects can violate it, and our classic example is still there. You can have an evaporating black hole. How do you see, by the way, that there's anti-focusing near an evaporating black hole? Forget about evaporating for a moment. Let's just take a classical black hole and consider the light rays that are just at the event horizon. Those are light rays which are running out as fast as they can towards larger radius, but space is collapsing underneath them, and they're just hovering as a result at fixed radius. They form a sphere, and they're trying to get out, but they can't. They're not falling in either. They're just in balance, right? Now, if I go some exponentially tiny amount outward from those light rays, and consider another family of outgoing light rays. Well, they're outside the event horizon. They're gonna eventually escape to great distances from the black hole. But I can make that last for a really long time by just starting them out really close to the event horizon, so they have to work their way out for a long time. Now let's switch on the evaporation and consider the same light rays. For a really long time, they stay near the horizon, but the horizon is shrinking. And so those light rays actually have negative expansion because they're very slowly, they're spanning a smaller and smaller area as the black hole is shrinking. But then eventually they get far enough away that they can run off to great distances. And so they are precisely doing that kind of anti-focusing thing. So indeed, we see that the classical focusing theorem in general relativity is once again violated in the presence of quantum effects, and in particular for an evaporating black hole. But that's just one example. You can, if you make a bunch of negative energy density somewhere and you send light waves through it, they really will anti-focus, something you could in principle measure. And so our goal here is that we're of course happy about that, right? We were trying to find some GR theorem that we can fix up into some quantum corrected thing so that we can then get rid of the gravity and go down to a new statement, hopefully new, about quantum field theory. So this is good. Here's something that's kind of classically correct, but quantum mechanically needs some kind of correction to it. And so our goal is to formulate a quantum corrected focusing theory. Here in this picture, I stole this. This just illustrates this kind of property is very important in cosmology and astrophysics, right? Lensing comes from this. So how do we do this? So here's again the picture I showed you earlier. The first thing I have to tell you is that even though generalized entropy was something that Bekenstein introduced in the context of black hole event horizons, he was interested in adding the area of an event horizon to the entropy outside of that particular surface. And he called that the generalized entropy, area plus S out. Right? There is nothing in that definition that is in any substantial way tied to the notion of an event horizon. You can start with any two-dimensional surface that divides space into one side and another side. You can call it the inside and the outside or whatever. And you can consider adding the area of that surface to the von Neumann entropy of the quantum fields restricted to that to one of the sides. It doesn't actually matter very much in what follows which side you pick as long as you stick to that one. So the claim will be that everything I say will hold no matter what the choice is. But that's going to be the idea. So to start with, we're going to consider generalized entropy for arbitrary surfaces so long as they divide all of space into two sides. So here's all of space. Here's one side of it. Here's the von Neumann entropy S out of that side. Now we want to connect that. We want to go a little further and connect that to the notion of the classical expansion. We want some quantum version of that. So the classical expansion had to do with how the area of a surface changes as I vary it along a bunch of light rays. Again, think of the laser guns. Right? If I start with this wall and I start firing out some laser rays, and I can actually deform only along some of them if I like. I don't have to move the whole plane forward. Either way, I can ask, how does the area change? In the example of the laser rays, it doesn't change at all. It doesn't look like that because it has these kinks, but they're of length zero because they're along light rays. It doesn't change at all because the laser rays are parallel to one another. Well, and actually changes a little bit because you guys are going to focus the laser rays a little bit. So in the end, it's going to decrease a little bit. That's the classical expansion. The quantum expansion, we can ask exactly the same question. How does the generalized entropy change? So again, we start with a wall. We look at the generalized entropy of all of space, meaning the area of the wall plus the von Neumann entropy of everything to one side of it. And now we deform the surface a little bit. And we ask again, what is now the area plus the entropy to that side? And we can take sort of infinitesimal limits of both the cross section over which I deform and the length over which I deform, and I can define a derivative. Right? I can ask, what is the rate of change of the generalized entropy as I deform my surface? So again, in general, we will not just be interested in deforming a surface, say, along all parts of it, but instead, we might want to consider a situation where we deform only, let me deform it outward here, we deform only a little bit along one of the light rays. Right. But either way, I can ask what is the generalized entropy of this region, and then compare it to the generalized entropy of this region. Meaning the area of this new surface plus the entropy outside here. Now I'm going to have some parameter of the deformation, which is the affine parameter, some kind of length along the light ray, if you will. And there's another choice that I can make, which is how big is the area element across which I will deform. It turns out that to leading order, the derivative with respect to lambda is proportional also to the size of this area element, so it's natural to divide by it and ask, you know, how much does the generalized entropy change per unit area in a sort of infinitesimal limit. Okay, so that's the natural object to consider, and that's the thing that is going to limit to the classical expansion in the h bar goes to zero limit when I turn off quantum mechanics. Okay. So here's the object. I think we can turn the lights down again so long as that doesn't switch projector off. So here's what we're doing. We're substituting for area, the generalized entropy, but we're still looking at its change per unit area. That's a minor subtlety. You have to know where to do the substitution and where not to do it. Initially, that was a little confusing, but that's the right thing to do. And we called this, predictably enough, capital theta. It is the quantum expansion. So it's the thing that if you take h bar that goes to zero, you get the classical expansion back, but it contains some quantum correction term. You don't just care about how the area changes. You also care about how the entropy of the exterior state changes as you make this deformation. And because you care about that, this quantity theta, I just want to say this in case it causes confusion, it depends not just on the place where I deform the surface and the local physics here. It depends on the surface elsewhere too. Because, for example, there could be an electron sitting here, which is entangled with another electron over here into an EPR-like state, a pure state. And it makes a big difference when I deform the surface here, whether this other electron is on this side or on that side of the surface little sigma. Right? In one version, I disrupt the entanglement. In the other version, I restore it when I deform the surface. And so the entropy can actually go up or down. Both possibilities are there. And so I should just emphasize that this is a non-local quantity in general. But that's OK. We can deal with that. So this definition was given in my paper with my student Zach Fisher and postdoc Stefan Leichenauer and Aaron Wall. And here's another picture of it where I've blown the surface up to at least a one-dimensional size. And I want you to think of the entropy on the exterior of it. So this is some kind of half spatial slice. As I deform along the light rays, here in this special example, the light rays have zero expansion in usually just one particular region. This is really a functional derivative. I'm avoiding that notation because it looks cumbersome, but you can always describe the location of the surface in terms of a function of the transverse positions, and then you can take a functional derivative and ask how does the of the exterior entropy plus area of the generalized entropy, how does that change under small deformations? So I know this is a somewhat technical definition, but I hope I've made it roughly clear what we're doing. We're still just deforming a little bit and asking not just how did the area change, that was the classical expansion, but how does the area plus exterior entropy change? That's the quantum expansion. Okay, so we can, of course, write down the quantum expansion, break it up into the classical piece and the quantum correction. That way you make it very explicit that it reduces to the classical expansion as h bar goes to zero. And little curly a here is supposed to be the size of the transverse area element. And wherever this appears, I'm implicitly taking the limit where it goes to zero. Right, so secretly, this s prime out, the prime is with respect to the affine parameter. That's also proportional to curly a. All right, so this is the whole sort of work you have to do. It's just finding the right definition. Once you have the right definition, the quantum conjecture that you want to make is totally trivial. We want to have a quantum correction to the classical focusing theorem, which says classical theta, little theta prime, is less than zero. Classical theta can only decrease, well, if the null energy condition holds. Of course, what we're going to do is replace the little by a big theta and say that the quantum expansion can only decrease big theta prime is less than or equal to zero, and claim that that will now happen no matter what. So we don't need the null energy condition anymore. So that's our conjecture. It's called, naturally, the quantum focusing conjecture. And I should stress, it is just a conjecture, but I think it has a lot of things going for it. It seems quite powerful in the sense that it contains, as special cases, many things that we either know to be true or have significant evidence for already. That doesn't, again, it doesn't mean it's right, but clearly something like it seems to be right. And indeed, it's like a discovery tool. We've actually discovered new things from it that we were then able to prove. So obviously, it restricts to the classical focusing theorem as h bar goes to zero. It's not hard to see that it implies Bekenstein's generalized second law. And then, of course, the classical limit thereof, Hawking's area theorem. I'll say briefly a few words about how it also includes in it, an improved, sort of more precise version of the covariant entropy bound. This is a sort of holographic statement that the entropy in a region cannot be bigger than the surface area surrounding it. And it also allows us to derive a conjectured generalized second law in cosmology that pertains to certain objects called holographic screens. This is interesting because very often you don't have an event horizon in your space-time, and you'd still like to say something about what the second law means, say, in an expanding universe. So again, this doesn't mean we have proven this generalized second law, but if you're willing to assume the quantum focusing conjecture, then this is just a special case. You can prove it from that. The thing I will spend most of my time on is a result that we have by now proven, but which is really hard to get from quantum field theory or prove from quantum field theory, but which comes out pretty simply from the quantum focusing conjecture, and which is the first lower bound on the local energy density of matter in terms of an information theoretic quantity. That's the quantum null energy condition. So let me see how I'm doing with time. I started at 2:05 or something. Okay, so I think we're doing okay. So let me say a few words about the covariant entropy bound. In this picture, I'm sorry about this sort of sparse pictures that relativists often draw. Again, light rays goes at 45 degrees, and keep in mind that almost every point here is really a two-sphere. If you want, if it helps, imagine rotating this picture around this line here, the edge of the at the edge of the slide. So this is a bigger two-sphere, this is a smaller two-sphere. This is like a piece of a cone. Okay. And we can look at space outside of the first one and outside of the second one, and we can define the generalized entropy in both cases. It's the entropy here plus this, entropy here plus the area of that. Okay. Now suppose that we consider, this is why this is a special case. Let's consider the special case where the quantum expansion at the first surface, sigma, is already negative. For example, because the area is decreasing a lot as you go away from it. It's like that cone that I just drew. Or maybe in any case, the area plus exterior entropy has to be decreasing initially. That's the assumption. Well, then the quantum focusing conjecture, which tells you that big theta prime is negative, that tells you that if big theta, the quantum expansion, was negative here, it certainly can't become positive along the way. It can only become more negative. It can only decrease. Which means, after integrating, that the quantum expansion itself will be negative everywhere here. And after integrating one more time, it means that the generalized entropy up here must be less than the generalized entropy down there. The generalized entropy difference here is such that, this generalized entropy minus that generalized entropy is positive. So that's this statement. That's what we get from the quantum focusing conjecture, starting with the assumption that the quantum expansion was already negative. What does that have to do with the covariant entropy bound? Well, we can unpack the generalized entropy into its two pieces, the ordinary matter entropy and the area, and move all the areas to one side and all the entropies to the other. And this is pretty much just literally the statement of the covariant entropy bound, that the entropy of the matter that passes through this light sheet, which in simple cases at least is what would be the entropy difference between these two slices, is bounded from above by the area difference between the two surfaces. We can take also the limit if you want, where this surface is just the tip of the cone, and that's kind of the holographic statement that the entropy enclosed in this surface is less than the area. Okay, so that's kind of an interesting statement all in its own right. It tells us that the number of degrees of freedom in nature don't scale, as you might naively think, like the volume, but only like the surface area. There's something fundamentally non-extensive when gravity is important. But it just comes out as a special case quite directly from this very simple generalization of a simple VR theorem. Let me leave the area theorem for holographic screens to the end in case I run out of time, because I do have to introduce some new ingredients. And instead return to the main line of the story that I want to emphasize. We have gotten halfway so far. We've done the GR to quantum gravity part, but we haven't yet done the quantum gravity to quantum field theory part. We've lifted a GR theorem to a semi-classical quantum gravity conjecture. Now the question is, what's the clever way of throwing away gravity? And it's really, you'll see, not quite throwing it away. It's just making sure it's at just the right strength so that we can learn something new about quantum field theory from this. What we want is a statement that has only h bar in it, only Planck's constant, and no longer Newton's constant. So looking again at the breakup of the quantum expansion into a classical one and the change, rate of change of the exterior entropy, you will, of course, notice that typically this is a small correction term and this is a leading term in a GH bar expansion. This is kind of manifest here. But I really want to stress this in the sense that the classical expansion doesn't even require gravity to be large. You can just have Minkowski space. You pick a round sphere, right? And the light rays coming off of it will have some large classical expansion given by either plus or minus 2 over the radius, turns out. So now if I started with a surface like that and included gravity and quantum effects perturbatively, of course, this correction wouldn't be important at all. You'd be totally dominated by this first term, and it would be the classical focusing theorem that's doing all the work in making sure that the quantum focusing conjecture is true. The quantum correction just isn't large enough to spoil anything. We want to be in a different regime where the quantum correction somehow matters a lot. Okay. And yet, we don't want to be like in the deep quantum gravity regime where this expansion breaks down and we have no control at all. How do we do that? Well, what we need to do is we need to make sure that this guy is small. Nobody forced me to stupidly choose a round sphere in Minkowski space. Why not choose a plane? Right? The light rays coming off of a plane are parallel to one another. They initially have zero expansion. Theta is zero. The only thing that contributes in that case is the quantum correction. Now, it's not going to stay that way. The light rays coming off of this plane, as I've said a few times, will get focused by you guys, and they will start having negative expansion. But that negative expansion is proportional to G Newton. How much they get focused depends on the strength of gravity. Right? And so the first term here will be of the same order in G Newton as the second term. And then stating that the derivative of this quantity is never positive, the quantum focusing conjecture, well, there's a zero on one side of that statement. We can just cancel the G Newtons out, throw them away. That's the strategy. Okay, so here's a picture of this. You saw this picture before, but now it really is important that these light rays are parallel to each other. This is not a circle or sphere. It's a plane. They come off of a plane. I've suppressed one spatial dimension, but think of these laser guns firing off of this wall. And now what's happening is that the quantum correction term, the S out, is changing, and the expansion is also changing, but only due to effects that are of order G Newton, due to these small focusing effects of whatever matter they encounter. Okay, so I think I've said this. Now both terms are of the same order by a judicious choice of the setting that I'm going to consider. But keep in mind that this is still a very general setting. If I'm interested in quantum field theory, at every point in space, there are infinitely many planes like that that go through that point. By choosing one of them, I can dial a particular null vector, the direction in which the laser rays are going. So there are a lot of statements that I can still make about what is happening at that point in Minkowski space in quantum field theory. Now, what I should have said earlier, I think, but anyway, I'll say it now, is that, of course, we're going to be interested in taking the limit where G Newton becomes small. Why is that? Well, because I want it to be unimportant whatever the second and third and fourth order effects are here. I want only the leading order effect in G Newton, the fact that matter focuses light, leading order at linear order, that's going to be the only thing that then becomes important, so we'll obtain an exact statement. Since G then cancels out completely, it really becomes an exact statement in quantum field theory. It has only, the final statement will only have H bar in it. So here comes the derivation, and even though this has more formulas on it than any other slide so far, I want you to appreciate the fact that this is the entire derivation of the quantum null energy condition from the quantum focusing conjecture with no steps left out. So it's actually incredibly simple. It's like a one-liner, right? I'm starting up here in the top left corner. This little thing here is the quantum focusing conjecture. Change of the quantum expansion is always negative, right? Here I'm unpacking the quantum expansion into change of quantum expansion is change of classical expansion plus some kind of second derivative stuff, right? The quantum expansion already has a first derivative of the exterior entropy, so now we have another prime that makes it a second derivative, and then there's a mixed term between the classical expansion and the S prime. So far, I haven't done anything at all. I've just expanded the quantity that I have defined. Now I'm going to use classical general relativity. I'm going to use something called Rachel-Dury's equation. So for those of you who are not familiar with that, that is simply an equation that you get out of Einstein's equations that tells you precisely what the change in the classical expansion is in a given setting. It is up to here, all those terms up to where I'm showing you, that's what theta prime is. It's given by some square of the expansion you already have, minus that, minus something called the shear square. The shear tells you, you know, suppose your light rays are expanding at a different rate in this plane than in that one. Then you have shear. For example, they could be converging in that plane and expanding. That will be captured by this shear tensor. It's not going to be very important here, but it can capture things like gravitational waves. And then finally, there's a term here, which is the matter that's doing some focusing. So this is telling you that even absent these two things, the classical expansion will decrease. There's a minus sign here. If there is matter present that satisfies the null energy condition. If this thing here is positive, I've explicitly put the quantum expectation values here because that's really what goes into this equation, right? And then notice that the rest I haven't done anything to this bit, right? It's still hanging on. And now the color coding is just which terms are still important when we restrict to the special setting that I've now advocated where we initially have zero expansion. I'm also going to arrange for it to have zero shear. Okay, so the classical theta and this shear are just going to vanish. That means all the black terms aren't going to be there. Only the red terms are going to be there. Here there's a factor of theta, so that goes away. And I'm left with only the red terms. Those now, in this special setting, are the things that have to be non-positive. By assuming the quantum focusing conjecture. And so I can put one term on one side and the others on the other. I've explicitly restored this limit where we make the cross-sectional area of the deformation small. And here's the statement that comes out. So the expectation value of this particular energy density that's seen by light in a particular direction, light moving in a particular direction, at any point in space. And I can choose this direction by orienting my surface in the right way. Is greater than or equal to some quantity that has to do with the second derivative of the entropy on one side of that surface. So since this has the form of a quantum correction to the ordinary null energy condition, we called it the quantum null energy condition. Right? The ordinary null energy condition that I showed you earlier just had a zero here. That's the thing that we know to be violated by things like Casimir energy and near a black hole horizon. So now we've kind of gone back all the way down to that level and try to fix that up directly. The null energy condition didn't work, but with this quantum correction, we claim to have an actual lower bound on the stress tensor on this particular component of it. Now, the lower bound, of course, depends on the state. And the right-hand side here is a non-local quantity, so I want to discuss that a little bit. But that's the result we got. It's the first such statement. And even though, you know, we got it from this quantum gravity idea of the quantum focusing conjecture, there is really no reason why we couldn't have guessed and proven this statement before. So I think it's quite remarkable that it was discovered this way. And it tells you that this way of thinking is perhaps actually useful, even if you're just interested in quantum field theory. The right-hand side, so it's long been known that there cannot be a universal lower bound on the local stress tensor. You can make the energy density arbitrarily small. And what the right-hand side here really does is it depends on the state that you're in. Right? But what's remarkable about it is that it's purely an information theoretic quantity. You just care about the second derivative of the von Neumann entropy under this deformation that you're considering in the direction of the light that enters into this component of the stress tensor. Right? I struggle a little bit with giving a sort of one-line slogan for what this statement physically means. I mean, the second derivative is like an acceleration, right? You could imagine that you're receiving information by light that's propagating to you. That's a little bit like considering the light on a fixed front and moving the boundary. Right? And the rate at which you're receiving information is like a first derivative of that deformation. The second derivative is how that rate changes. What this is telling you is that if you want to receive information at a faster rate from your friend, you have to ask your friend to use more positive energy in his signal. If you're happy with a lower rate at which you're receiving information from your friend, then it will be okay for your friend to include some negative energy in their signal. That's about as close as I can get to. Now, on the other hand, I mean, that's close enough that you could actually try to measure something like this in the lab to the extent that we can mock up direct measurements of the entropy through something like replicas of systems. There are ways of doing that. All right, so this is the statement we got. We got it in one line from the quantum focusing conjecture, but it has only H bar in it, and so in principle, we should be able to attack this problem purely within quantum field theory. We're supposed to understand quantum field theory. This should be true in a standard model. It should be true in really any relativistic, Lorentz invariant, unitary quantum field theory. And so we tried doing that, and we quickly realized that it was quite hard. And so we restricted our attempt to free fields, very simple quantum field theories. And the proof is, you know, 15 or 20 pages that look like that. So what you do is you consider formulating the quantum field theory directly on the light front, on such a null hypersurface, on such a surface that's generated by just parallel light waves propagating through Minkowski space. That's called light front quantization. And for free theories, this was pointed out by Aaron Wall, it turns out that the vacuum of the theory is just a product state over all the individual light rays that make up this null plane. Okay. This is very special to light front quantization. It would not be true, of course, on a spatial slice that you could somehow factorize the vacuum in that way. It's a very special property. And because it's true, it means that in any finite energy state, if you look at a sufficiently small neighborhood of a light ray, you know, it's very unlikely that there's more than one particle there. And in fact, even if there's one wave packet, you'll only see a tiny part of it. It'll look like you're very close to the vacuum. And that gives us a small expansion parameter we can work with. It's the deviation from the vacuum, which you can make as small as you like by just making that neighborhood very small. That neighborhood is like the curly A that we're going to deform along. And so you can expand the state in that particular sort of pencil or neighborhood of one light ray that you're going to deform along as the vacuum rho naught plus some tiny small correction. And you can expand the entropy and powers of that correction, right? It's the entropy of that you would have had in the vacuum plus a little bit of a correction. And so when you organize it in these powers, you find that the zeroth and first order terms, if we were able to just stop there, we would find that those are exactly equal. The second derivative of them is exactly equal to the stress tensor. So that would be saturation of the quantum null energy condition. At that point, it wouldn't even be an inequality. So then the remaining task is to show that the remaining terms have a definite sign, that they're all, the second derivative is always negative. And you can do that by using what's called the replica trick, computing Reni entropies, which are easier to calculate directly than the von Neumann entropy. But the von Neumann entropy can be obtained by an analytic continuation. You can see that this is, you know, by comparison with, you know, my fairly primitive light rays and deformations of some surface, it's all very simple. This is pretty technical. I mean, I thought we were doing hard work, you know, proving this. And that's what I think is so nice and striking about this, that while it's true in quantum field theory and you can work hard to prove it, it's very clear that this is not the natural way to understand the quantum null energy condition. This is the really awkward, difficult way to understand it. It's much easier to understand it by first including gravity and then taking the limit where gravity is not very important. And that's the sense in which I think this is hinting at a unification in a way that we haven't seen it much before, that quantum gravity is somehow built into quantum field theory. And this pertains to states of that could have quite low energies, actually. This is not some extremely high energy phenomenon. So how do we go beyond that? So we proved it for these free field theories. The next step was taken by Stefan Leichenauer and my student Jason Culler, who proved that the quantum null energy condition also holds for interacting quantum field theories with what's called a gravity dual. And again, there'll be many in this room to whom this is totally obvious, but maybe some where it's not. So we actually have a full quantum gravity theory for a class of spacetimes called anti-de Sitter spacetimes. And roughly speaking, with time going up once again, these look like an infinite cylinder. So you can bounce a light ray off of the boundary and it'll come back to you. Quantum gravity inside this spacetime is fully described by a particular quantum field theory, a conformal field theory that happens to be very strongly coupled and has a lot of fields in it. It's a large end field theory. And we can turn this correspondence around. So there's the evidence for this correspondence is enormous, I would say. But if you will, that is an assumption in this proof that this correspondence holds. And you can use gravity in the bulk, just classical gravity in certain regimes, that's good enough, to compute all sorts of non-trivial properties of this conformal field theory. This is a sort of perverse viewpoint where even though you just had this wonderful luxury of a quantum gravity theory, what are you going to do with it? You're going to waste it on proving something about conformal field theory without gravity. But hey, sometimes that's what is what we need. In this case, what you can do is you can compute the entanglement entropy or the von Neumann entropy of a region on the boundary, sort of analogous to what's on one side of some surface, by computing certain minimal surface areas in the bulk. You look at you anchor a minimal surface on that boundary and you hang it down into the bulk, and you compute its area, and then by looking at how that area changes, you're really computing how the entanglement entropy in the conformal field theory changes. So that's all, you know, fairly elaborate in terms of the actual work you have to do, calculations you have to do. This idea of computing entropy in this indirect way was due to Ryu and Takeyanagi. And one property that must be true is that there's a certain nesting property. If this is my boundary, here's time going up, and here's such a minimal surface hanging into the bulk, and I now consider a smaller region on the boundary, it must be true that its minimal surface is entirely contained within the one of the bigger region. That's true for a subtle reason that has to do with the fact that you can actually describe all of the physics in this region with data, conformal field theory data, only here. So it'd be crazy if by restricting to a smaller region, all of a sudden you'd have more information about bulk regions that you didn't have access to before. So this is some kind of fairly basic property that this entanglement entropy has to have. And it's that property that Stefan and Jason were able to exploit to prove that the quantum null energy condition holds for interacting theories, in this case, the theory on the boundary, an interacting theory that has such a gravity dual. That's still a limited class of interacting theories, but given that we now have all free theories and a fairly large group of strongly coupled interacting theories for which the quantum null energy condition must be true, of course, that gives you some confidence that maybe it really is true. And then indeed, about half a year ago, a proof was given for the sort of remaining case of all non-free, all interacting theories, not using this quantum gravity theory that Maldacena found, this bulk boundary correspondence, but just working directly in the interacting field theory. So this made our free theory proof look fairly trivial. I mean, this is like 70 or 80 pages by Tom Faulkner and his group. And what they did is quite amusing, I think. So there are all sorts of fix-ups to the null energy condition that were previously formulated. What's special about ours is that we directly refer to the energy density at one point in space-time. Another very nice fix-up, which follows from ours, it's a weaker statement, is the average null energy condition, where you sum the energy density or you integrate the energy density along a whole light ray, an infinite light ray. It has to have the property that it never enters its own future, which would be true in Minkowski space, but not in all spacetimes. But you just integrate the stress energy. So then even if it's negative in some places, the claim is that it's always positive when you integrate all along the light ray. That's the average null energy condition. It's a weaker statement. And it was odd that there had been two proofs of it, which used completely different techniques. One sort of more used causality, and another proof was based more on quantum information type concepts. One of them was due to Faulkner, and another one was due to Tom Hartmann. And they both were able to prove this average null energy condition. Why are there two ways of doing that? Well, in hindsight, it's because you need to put them both together to prove the stronger statement of the quantum null energy condition. So that's what Tom and his collaborators did. They really used all of the, it's like throwing the kitchen sink. I mean, they used everything that they had at their disposal to prove the quantum null energy condition in interacting field theories. And so now we know it's true. But again, I want to stress, this was really hard work by a lot of people to prove it within quantum field theory. And I do not find these proofs particularly illuminating conceptually. I wouldn't know how to explain them to you in a reasonable amount of time. So again, I want to stress that I think this is really a hint that we're learning something that's much more naturally understood from the point of view of quantum gravity, even though it's a statement about seemingly non-gravitational physics. So I want to close with just some brief remarks about recent and ongoing work. I cheated throughout this whole talk. I cheated by presenting the quantum null energy condition and really the quantum focusing conjecture as if there was just sort of one derivative along one light ray that was involved. I mean, one second derivative, right? But really, to define the expansion, we already needed one functional derivative. And the second derivative is a second functional derivative. You can vary the function that defines where the surface is, not necessarily twice at the same point. In general, you could vary it here and here. So what we really are considering is a kind of matrix. There are off-diagonal and diagonal terms. A second functional derivative has a delta function when the two points coincide. That's because then dividing twice by the cross-sectional area and taking the limit where it goes to zero introduces an unnecessary 1 over 0. So you strip off that part. That gives you a delta function. But the thing that I discussed was really just the coefficient of that delta function. But there's a whole host of other statements, which are the off-diagonal quantum focusing conjecture and the off-diagonal quantum null energy condition, where you vary the surface at two different points. That one's actually easier to prove. We were able to prove that immediately from what's called the strong subadditivity of the entanglement entropy. It's just piggybacking on the hard work of people who have already proven a certain property of quantum mechanics. So that's why I didn't talk too much about the off-diagonal part of the quantum focusing conjecture and the quantum null energy condition. But in fact, it looks like that part is more interesting than we originally thought. Because even though we derived the quantum null energy condition as an inequality, the evidence now appears to be that it's an equality. This diagonal part, to be precise, is actually an equality. And so when you think about that for a moment, that seems to lead to a whole host of contradictions. For example, it would seem to suggest that the average null energy condition is always saturated. The integral of all the energy density has to be zero. That makes no sense. What's really happening is that no matter how small you make the area over which you deform the surface, if you deform far enough, the off-diagonal terms become important. And this has been checked explicitly by these people. They become important, and they restore an inequality from what would otherwise just be an equality. And that's a good thing. Because, for example, it's clearly true that I could have a coherent wave packet which has no entropy at all, is a pure state, and I don't want the entropy to suddenly blow up just because I cross a certain amount of energy density. So it better be an inequality. And this is we're now sort of discovering what's happening under the hood and how the quantum focusing conjecture makes that happen. It's really an interplay of these off-diagonal and diagonal terms. And this is work which is recently published, like about a week or two ago, by Leichenauer, my student Adam Levine, and another student, Arvind Shabazi-Moganam. And they proved the saturation property, again, holographically using this kind of argument, but with a more refined calculation that directly accesses the entropy and not just proves an inequality, but shows that it's equal. The second derivative is equal to the stress tensor. And then the second step, where you want to then prove this completely generally for interacting quantum field theories, is currently being worked out, and I think it's essentially done by the same group, plus Tom Faulkner, another student of mine, Van Chandrasekaran, and one of Tom's students. And so this is very much something that's still evolving and developing. I should stress that for free field theories, even the diagonal part is an inequality. This is a very bizarre situation where interacting quantum field theories are in some way simpler than free ones. For interacting theories, what was otherwise an inequality is just an equality. But this is still evolving. Again, the message here is that we can learn something about non-gravitational physics, about quantum field theory, by thinking about gravity. I think that's a beautiful testament to the unity of physics. Thank you. Can you just speak up a little?
Quantum field theories can have gravitational anomalies. And so I can couple them to gravity, those theories to gravity. Do these theorems hold for those cases as well?
Yeah, so what we're assuming here implicitly, of course, is that our field theory can be coupled to gravity. And in fact, you know, if it can't, for example, it's not immediately obvious what we would mean by the stress tensor. So the stress tensor that I want to think about here is the thing that you get by varying the action with respect to the metric. I guess in the spirit of what has worked very well here, I would then argue that we should really think about quantum field theory as something that is made sense of through its the UV completion of a quantum field theory should involve gravity. And then these statements will be correct. But it's not at all obvious that that's necessarily true.
How does that show up in the quantum field theory?
Yeah, so in a quantum field theoretic proof, what's really being used is the assumption that the field theory has a conformal fixed point in the UV, which is either interacting or free, depending on the two cases that we considered. And again, the statement that we are exploring doesn't even make sense in some sense when that's not true. Because even though we're working at low energies, we're looking at deformations of a surface along a light ray. And so we're looking at the difference between, let's say, two points in space-time, which are actually separated by zero spatial distance, because they're separated by a light ray. And so it's in that sense that we're accessing the ultraviolet. It's not in the sense of having very high energy, but we're so if the theory wasn't defined in the ultraviolet, then we wouldn't even know what the statement means that we're.
I can have chiral fermions. It's a free theory and has gravitational anomaly.
Yeah.
So defined in the ultraviolet, but I won't expect this theorem to be true for them.
If it's well defined in the ultraviolet, I don't think there should be a problem.
So you think the theorem will hold true even though I cannot couple to gravity?
If the theory in the ultraviolet is not conformal.
It's free theory, so it's ultraviolet, UV complete.
Yeah, but if it's not conformal, then the proofs would not apply. So even if it's free but not conformal, then the proofs would not apply.
Any other questions? Students are invited.
So you said there is an equality. What is the equality?
So the equality, I didn't make that clear. So the inequality that I was advertising is this one. And for free fields, there really is an inequality. But that's the thing that's an equality for interacting fields. In the sense that by S double prime, that notation refers explicitly to deforming twice along the same null generator. So that's a statement about the diagonal part of the quantum focusing thing.
So I guess I don't really understand that. So you're saying that if it's an equality, then if S bar is equal to zero, that TKK is equal to zero. So I don't understand how this could be an equality.
Yeah, that's what it is. Inequality. So you can just compute it directly, right? So you compute the second derivative of the exterior entropy. It's extremely surprising. I completely agree. And you know, this shouldn't even be a local quantity, right? But you find that all the non-local contributions drop out, and the answer is the stress tensor up to these factors here. So this is not obvious, and it naively leads to all sorts of contradictions. But what's important is that if I consider, let's say I have some null plane like this, right? And I consider an extremely small deformation of what is originally a plane. I move one surface up along one of the light rays a little bit. It turns out that I can't integrate this equality to compute what the entropy is out here using my knowledge of what the stress tensor is here. I can't integrate that for arbitrarily long distances, because at some point the off-diagonal contributions do become important no matter how small I made this cross-sectional area. And that's where apparent contradictions, such as the apparent saturation of the average null energy condition, which would be absurd, that's how those get resolved. And you can see that explicitly in examples where you know how to calculate the entropy. But it's very surprising, this interplay between the diagonal and the off-diagonal terms. And it's something that I think, you know, we've only sort of scratched the surface of how that works.
Also, I think you may be forgetting the right-hand side also depends on the state.
That's very important, yeah.
Any questions, comments? Okay, not the same Raffaele.